netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Hey, and greetings from on the road here on the FX Podcast in our annual post-NAB trip in the car heading back to LA with Jeff and Mike. And a bit of a convention-weary crowd, having just done our live streaming netcast yesterday. But how you guys feeling?
Good.
Good. Got some Starbucks. We're on our way.
Latte'd up.
Latte'd up. Well, I think the streaming event during the second year was a success. It was a lot of fun. And boy, I mean, 6 hours may seem like a lot of time, but when you're actually in the thick of it, it seemed like it took about 2 hours. A lot of fun, and we have that available still on the website. If you go to fxguide.com/NAB Live, you'll be able to see a replay of the live stream, and maybe by the time you hear this, even broken apart into individual segments for you to watch.
And of course, if you haven't heard our post-NAB wrap-up before, we might want to explain the background noise. We're actually driving from Vegas back to LA, and we got into the habit of recording this because we sit in the car, we chat about what we saw, and we thought, hey, why don't you join us for the trip? So if you guys are wherever you are, sit back and relax. I can tell you it's a beautiful day. Sun's shining. Jeff is at the wheel.
I'll get us there, don't worry.
No distracted driving. So where should we start?
Do you want to go around and highlight of the show, kind of from a new or unexpected product point of view?
Sure. I'll take it. I'll take my highlight of the show. A few years ago, we saw Blackmagic kind of come in and start some disruption, kind of start, you know, the whole DaVinci thing, dropping the price from the old hardware model to software and free even. And last year, they introduced the camera, and of course, there were some delays getting it out. And then this year was the Pocket Cinema Camera, $995, and then the 4K for 4K. So, I mean, I think that was definitely the talk of the show, as far as I could tell.
So the layout of the show was pretty funny, wasn't it? I mean, you had this huge Blackmagic stand, and right next to it was Red. So what did Blackmagic do?
Yeah, the first time ever they put a wall between the two, and on the wall facing the Red booth were illuminated signs touting their 4K camera and their new Pocket 1920 camera, but their camera lineup basically was the first three panels.
Yeah, you basically got a huge number of Blackmagic products, and they just basically stuck up a wall of camera signs facing Red, which is really funny if you think about it, because if you're going to Red, you'd be facing the Red stand saying, hey, what's new? But you'd have your back to Blackmagic. But if you were a Red employee, you'd be standing there facing the crowd, just staring all day at Blackmagic cameras.
I mean, it couldn't have been worse unless they had put maybe for the fourth sign a finger on the wall.
Yeah, I think that's what it was.
Yeah, yeah, I guess that was implied.
Yes, implied. But yeah, and it was even one of those narrow aisles, right, guys? It was not like across the big main aisle. We're talking, this is that one of those little narrow aisles that you go to get to, and you know, actually the entrance, the open side also of the Red booth. Their other side was kind of closed off as well. But yeah, it was quite interesting and a bit of fun, I think. From the Blackmagic design company.
So, I mean, that camera looks like a point-and-shoot. I've been calling it a point-and-film because it actually doesn't take stills. It only does video. But it looks like a point-and-shoot, doesn't it?
Yeah, it looks like a normal Nikon, Canon iPhone with a hand grip, really.
So if I was on the RC, I'd say to Jason, so, would you buy one? So let me say it to you two.
Well, if I was Jason, I'd say no because it's not a full-frame sensor.
No.
Oh, myself?
Yeah.
Well,
is it enough to put your own money down?
I've placed a pre-order myself personally. I don't know if I'll actually take it, but I figured we might as well get in the queue and see what we decide then. I need to do some research. I frankly have been ignoring Micro Four Thirds completely out of self-preservation because I knew it was something I might get interested in at some point when I get tired of lugging the 5D Mark III around.
John?
Pre-ordered as well. Jeff pointed out the link to me on B&H Photo. He's well ahead of me in the queue. I waited until I got back to the hotel in the evening to put it, but I figure I might as well put a hold on it, if you would. I could see it being useful from a utility standpoint. Second camera we're filming with the 5D, perhaps. I've gotten so used to doing our FX Guide TV interviews utilizing the 5D. It just feels natural, size for traveling, things like that. And, you know, at $9.95, it's kind of worth a play with. Again, the option's open to not get it. And there are a lot of really great Micro Four Thirds lenses out there. It's kind of a fun little genre, I think. So
yeah, as usual, I posted to Twitter saying, anybody got any suggestions on Micro Four Thirds lenses? And got quite a few responses. I got to plow through when we get home and look at them and stuff. But yeah, it seems like there's a lot of choices. And like you say, for a second camera especially, you know, they were some people were talking about us maybe even using it for a crash cam.
Yeah, I'm not tempted. I mean, I think it's really interesting. I think it's indicative of the, you know, Moore's law of cameras, that they're basically replacing their own camera a year later. Because it is, effectively,
yeah.
You know, you can get a four-thirds mount on a current Blackmagic camera. So it's the same OS. In fact, it's going to be the same OS on the small point and film as the current Blackmagic camera, as the 4K camera, which is coming out later. The smaller one's going to be shipping by July. But Jeff, you raised a really interesting point, didn't you, about the record times?
Oh, I'm curious. I think in the article you wrote on FX Guide about the Moore's Law thing from NAB, that I think it was 50 minutes at ProRes.
422, right?
Also. It's 422, which is really interesting.
But then I just don't know what. I haven't looked for the spec. It dawned on me as we were getting in the car this morning. I wonder what that works out to for RAW, because I've heard complaints about the existing Blackmagic camera. The RAW is great, but it's very large file size. So I don't know the answer to that. But I mean, I guess the SD cards are getting bigger all the time, and you can afford to have a lot of them. And I think you pointed out, what's a roll of film? 4 minutes?
Yeah, exactly.
So,
I mean, isn't that the really interesting thing about it? It's not that it's an HD camera, because they've got a lot of those.
Yeah.
It's that it's being able to produce high-quality RAW files, whereas the 5D, John, that you were talking about, I mean, with 8-bit H.264.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I could also see myself, just from a, you know, almost a hobbyist standpoint, I'd love to have a nice camera like that for some of the hikes and stuff that I do, you know, take some nice nature footage and things like that. I like it at that size and factor. It's really interesting, the feel of it when you hold it in your hand. It really is just like a larger Micro Four Thirds camera, really, that you'd be holding, the kind of pocket camera that's just barely small enough to fit in your pocket. I mean, it is a large pocket that you'd have to fit this in. I don't think you're going to see a lot of dudes in skinny jeans carrying this thing around in their pocket.
That's right. Well, in fact, it's so similar that it uses Nikon batteries, right?
Yeah. So... anyway,
it doesn't come with one, by the way.
I don't want it, because I don't want to have to buy another set of lenses.
No,
because the only thing I know is that I'm changing camera backs all the time, but I'm keeping the same lenses. So
get an adapter.
No, but I just want to invest in lenses and then just not invest in camera backs that often, because they just, you know, keep changing. I don't know.
That's a good point. That's why I think I could use it, like I said, in my, you know, outdoor activities quite a bit. The idea of having some nice raw nature footage and stuff that I've shot is really attractive to me in that form, because I am not going to carry around, I'm not going to carry around in general a couple lenses or even the 24-70
I totally agree. For you hiking, it makes total sense.
Yeah,
but if you're happy with only video, you're not going to be able to take any panoramic stills. You could take panoramic video, but you can't take... You're only going to have 1920x1080 stills.
Yeah, but that in a combination... Yeah, that in a combination with my, raw... You know, small raw Canon camera is a nice combo for the pack.
I'm hoping that before this thing ships, somebody has the sense to put a one frame or... You know, although it's too small then, I guess, right? It's not the megapixels you would necessarily
want. It's
going to
be 1920x1080.
Yeah, exactly. And you asked them that, right? The sensor's not bigger than that. It is 1920x1080.
I think it's a really interesting camera. Don't get me wrong, I just personally not going to put any money down on it. But that being said, if I was hiking, which I don't do, I can totally see that use. Or if I wanted to use a crash cam, an oversized GoPro.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. Well, I guess the adapter thing that I threw out isn't really that useful when you think about what you say it was, 2.2 magnification on the lens.
Oh, yeah, it's horrendously...
So a 50 becomes more than 100?
There's
no such thing as a wide-angle lens.
An 18 becomes a 50 kind of thing. I mean, we were filming with the Blackmagic cameras on the booth, and I had my main problem with the Blackmagic cameras on the booth, and I didn't have a problem, but if I had a problem, it was that we were sticking lenses on there that I mentally thought would be good, like a 24, and it looked more like a 50
yeah.
or beyond, whereas we had to stick like an 8mm fisheye on a Blackmagic camera. Now, it cropped in on it, so you didn't get the circular look, but that gave me the kind of wide field of view that I was mentally thinking we were going to get out of a 14 or a 24, but our 14s and 24, while still, you know, valid, just right. weren't as wide as I was expecting.
Yeah. Well, it surprised me when I moved from the 7D to the 5D Mark III. The 24 to 70 I bought before I moved over, and I did not like that lens on the 7D. I just hated the range. And this is worse, because it's more, 2.2 instead of 1.6, and magnification. So I'm like, for me, directing the show, I was frustrated by the fact that the 24 to 70 on one of the Blackmagics was not wide enough and not really tight enough. You know, in TV, you get spoiled, going back to my old TV days of, you know, these giant lenses on cameras are there for a reason, because those cameras can do anything from super wide angle to super telephoto. And they should, because they cost more than everything we've discussed so far in this podcast for just the lens. But the, you know, it's kind of, it is an interesting thing to think about. And I get why Jason oftentimes expresses his distaste for non-full frame, because it is hard, especially if you love wide stuff.
But John, you and I were talking on the end of the FX Guide Live thing, I think it was, about how the other thing that Blackmagic were doing that's part of that same pipeline is, and it's not very sexy, I know, but it's interesting, the 6G implementation to allow you to do Hyper HD, or basically 4K, down what would otherwise be cables that are too narrow. So you don't have to run, you know, four cables or two cables. You can run the 6G stuff. And that seemed to be all the way through the Blackmagic pipeline pretty much, which was...
If you're going to introduce a camera that does 4K at 4K, and in the Blackmagic, you know, it seems like their, you know, company thing is hardware selling, and that's, you know, with giving away the DaVinci software for free, one could argue. You need to have a workflow for that. And am I correct, Mike? And the entire line now, just they basically updated their entire line to be 6G, of even though converters and
at
so
the
forth
risk
as well?
Of somebody pointing out there's something that they didn't, it certainly felt like it was their entire line. And they were certainly saying that some of their current products, they'd wanted to implement it before and they hadn't quite been able to do it, so that they were now sort of revving current products. So yeah, I would agree with that.
With a software upgrade?
No, it was more like like they designed it. It wasn't like you had to get a whole new version. It was just like, if you were buying it now, it would have that, because that was the capability of how it was built. You know, rather than having to wait till each product had a complete new iteration.
Right, understood.
Oh, I gotcha.
And I think that's really significant, because if you're trying to accommodate a 4K workflow, because, you know, everything's going that way, or is it? But anyway, let's just
the next topic.
Then you just don't want to have to recable a facility massively and deal with a kind of, because the infrastructure of a, you know, 12 room post house, which would be a completely sort of, you know, standard mid-sized kind of place. Well, you know, that's a lot of mucking around with gear and switches and stuff like that, as we all know from working in exactly those kind of facilities.
So 6G can use the existing the standard cable?
It's designed to go down, well, depending on what you call the existing cable, right? It's like an SDI cable, but it's a higher protocol implementation. Now, like in the days of like CAT with you had to like get the right grade to start with, yeah.
So that's interesting.
What was your pick of the show, John?
Well, I want to, you know, point out something that I think wasn't at the show. following up on some stuff that we've had, and our background, obviously, is as flame artists. That's how we all met, to actually start FX Guide. But I had always looked forward in the past to the, you know, way past the discrete user group meeting, where you get to see, you know, the latest software, some new technology, creative tools, things like that. And even on the show floor recently under Autodesk, they've been showing new software. But what they were showing this year was the service pack to the 20th anniversary release, and not showing new creative features on the show floor as part of their software. And I think, to me, what that says, and got confirmation from Philippe Suero, the lead product designer, is that, you know, they maybe learned the lesson about showing stuff a bit too soon and having to do the old recognition of revenue within the quarter that they announce and show something. I basically feel some of their, while you can work around some of those issues financially for the company, I think they've probably got boxed into a corner at times and having to ship and release software before they were ready to. You know, maybe if it took a longer time. You know, a year ago, Smoke on Mac was introduced at NAB, and for that one, they did a special thing that they didn't have to release it right away and recognize revenue. But I kind of think with showing the Flame premium software at IBC like they did, it seemed like they got a little backed into a corner that way. So we talked to actually Philippe in our live stream that we had, and I asked him about it, and he's like, yeah, basically, you know, we should get our shit together first before showing stuff and making sure it works, which I think is, you know, I think it's important and good that they realize that.
There was kind of a little bit of a theme of that. Maybe it was just us about delivering stuff that you show, that people are really frustrated by that. Maybe it's from the camera side of things, but in general, I sense that thread. I mean, Canon's booth actually had the word deliver in about 4-foot-tall letters everywhere you could look.
Yeah, and I think also the software that they were showing that I've been using in beta, and I said I could talk about it. You know, Philippe, in that interview I did on the podcast at the end of the year, basically, you know, effectively promised they're really serious about working on some of these performance issues that they had in the software that they released, and things like the really slow media browsing in the Media Hub, the desktop that was, you know, so sluggish compared to the previous one. You know, you love the desktop, you just cut and pasting, moving around, it just feels flexible, and the new release didn't feel that way. But they're now in their third service pack, and this one is coming out, I think, in May. You can see that they've really made some improvements in that. The file browsing, even in certain instances, is faster than the native browsing of proxies that they had before. That's optimized. The desktop is optimized. They have new notifications for some of the background rendering, so you know what's going on in the software. That's one of the incredibly frustrating things about using the software now, is you send a job off, they all happen as a background process, but you just have to have faith that it's going to do it. You know, it's like, yeah, I have no faith. I mean, it's like a podcast, I didn't have any faith. But they have improved that. It's much more stable. You actually have a pop-up little heads-up display with a progress bar that, actually shows you the progress. And as Philippe pointed out, it doesn't just jump from 0 to 99% as part of it. So I think it's a positive sign, you know, that they are making these changes. You know, they have a long way to catch up, I think.
Is there something there that now tells you how big the percentage is full of your hard, of your disks and your hards or drive on your local machine? So I've got to tell you, when I first got the version of Flame, it was like, well, where do I look to see how full my frame store is? What? There must be, there was always on the front of Flame, right in the middle. Well, we haven't got that working yet.
Yeah. And there's a cool little user group meeting on, I don't say it's little, a user group meeting on Monday evening, and Philippe actually, they took this time to actually show some tips and tricks and stuff. So he, things like he showed how to do like a false reflection by utilizing, rotating your axes, having your camera invert, and then rotating it back in order. So you do it the right way, which is kind of cool. And that kind of spoke a little bit to those previous user group meeting that we had. And, again, I think it would say they have some catching up to do, but I respect the fact that now I think they're going to get their stuff together, get the software working before they promise to have it available to us. Because I think a lot of the perception of 20th anniversary release was hurt because of some of those issues. And I wish now, this is when I think they should have released the software. And now delayed it until NAB. I mean, what was the harm in doing that anyway? So anyway, that's something I thought that was quite interesting at the show.
I guess for me, it's really hard to go to a single thing. Like, I'd say there are three things that, because they're so different parts of my life, I guess. Like, so the three things were, if I had to say the most innovative, clever thing I saw, it was
Let's start with your number one of all, you know, because, you know, the last thing, what would be your number one? Then we'll dive into your three.
Okay, well,
it was picking our number one thing. So
yeah, new that I hadn't expected fun thing was the Movi camera platform.
Oh, yeah.
And I'll tell you why, because we shot in New Zealand with gyros, and before I got there, I saw the amazing Vincent Laferrette, sort of short film that he did. And I thought that it had gyros in it that would make it quite weighty, because the gyros we shot with John in New Zealand for out the side of helicopters in the South Island, which was awesome, was really heavy. I mean, we had a pogo stick that's part of that rig, so you can rest it on the outside running board of the of the helicopter, because you just, you know, couldn't hold that weight up without being a major body lifter, weight lifter. But it wasn't, because it's done by servos that are basically digital. So you've got a correction to the camera's position based on inclinometers and accelerometers, as opposed to a gyro-based heavy spinning mass that gives it an inertia framework. When they handed me that rig to play with, I was stunned at how light it was.
Same here.
It's interesting, yeah. A beautiful piece of equipment, man. Yeah, Stu was actually, after his segment on our live stream, he was backstage, and, you know, he was just, like, loving it. In fact, I wanted his picture taken with it, you know, using it, because it's so friggin' cool.
In fact, if you go to the replay on that segment on FX Sky TV Live that we did at the show, we don't mention it while they're showing the rig, but if you wait around to the next segment, we actually recorded the rig as they were playing with it on the set, and then show the footage, and you'll just be kind of stunned at how, you know, you can see them just casually tossing the thing around, and
we were rocking it around. I mean, we were like shaking.
Yeah, you had to watch that segment of seeing what Jason was doing with it, right? To really fully understand how cool it was and what he was doing. Yeah.
But to sort of add to that, because you've got computer control of it as opposed to gyro control, like when I quickly shifted left to right on the gyro, it would have a ratchet thing that would basically say, okay, so clearly you're wanting to reset, so I'm going to kind of disengage the mechanism, as it were, and kind of click, click, click around to where you're going to get stable again, and then I'll kind of gyro lock in, so you're not just trying to fight it around. In the case of the digital version with this rig, which is, if you haven't seen it, it's a cage with two handles either side, suspending inside that cage the camera. As you swing it like hard from a right to left pan, you can have it set up for what's called, I think, magnificent pan. And what it does
is majestic pan.
That's right. And so basically, what it does, it says, "Oh, okay, you were looking, you know, kind of to the west. You now look kind of to the east. I know you got there really quickly, but I'll just slowly go around." So what you get is, you know, not just that it's smooth as I go around, but the speed at which I go around is slowed down, and then it sweeps in and catches up to where I'm at to end up with a usable shot, which is just pretty bright.
I kind of compared it to, you know, what's it called in After Effects, the new stabilizer that tries to make intelligent camera moves.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't just, everybody's always tackled the tracking problem at a stabilizer.
Of locking it down.
As here's a pin in this point, and Adobe was like, no, we want to make this walking shot into a Steadicam shot, and we understand what that's supposed to look like, so we'll try to make the footage. I kind of think of it as that. It might not be the same thing, but that's what it reminded me of.
But if I can do it,
I'm curious what your other two are.
Yeah, two other things is that the thing that I really enjoyed and I would look forward to using if I had an opportunity is the Cook anamorphics. And there are a lot of new anamorphics appearing, which I think is awesome. I mean, Arri now does 4.3, so it's a full height, so that you can put an anamorphic on there and get really the advantage of that, because otherwise you put an anamorphic on, you'd be cropping in on the Arri sensor, which would mean that you would get a pretty limited number of line heights. So that's good, but obviously it works on an Epic and other things as well. And some of the people that are doing those anamorphics are trying to make them quite free of anamorphic artifacts. They're trying to make them as sort of, you know, perfect and sort of clinical and modern as you can possibly get. And Cook is kind of going that way by saying, yeah, but we're not going to try and make it 100% like that, because otherwise, why wouldn't you just shoot full frame and then crop it in black? And now, for those of you listening, yes, we understand that's not mathematically the same, because you get a different depth of field horizontally than vertically on an anamorphic by the nature of the stretch. But still, you get the point, right? Like, it's going to look like you've just kind of cropped it top and bottom. Whereas Cook's going, yeah, let's keep some of that kind of character of an anamorphic, which means you get a really just cool look. I mean, we put that lens up, and shots just looked cool. So, yeah, I like that. Oh, and the third one, I just got to say, my favorite product at the moment, and it's not particularly new. In fact, it's not very new at all. But I went to a few specialist talks about high-end workflow, is Premiere. I just love Premiere at the moment. I'm just falling in love with the more I do with it, and the more I get, you know, to talk to hardcore Premiere users, the more impressed I am. And, you know, obviously moved to Final Cut, and I'm not an avid editor, and I'm not really an editor, but I just love doing stuff in Premiere. And when I see where Adobe's doing with it and where they're going with it and some of the stuff that's coming down the pipe with it that we've already talked about. I just think it's great, and I just, I feel good using it. It makes me smile. I'm not hitting my head against the brick wall, just yelling at them, going, what the hell are you doing?
Oh, this is a big topic. We could go for a long while on this. I was surprised. I thought editing would be a bigger... I thought there'd be something more. I guess we were all kind of waiting to see what Apple was going to do, if they were going to announce a new machine, because that was rumored.
Yes, please.
Yeah, and apparently not. But, you know, Apple also doesn't really play by time schedule, so that may not be a milestone for them. One of the things I observed was, as ubiquitous as Final Cut, when you saw any demo, they would always show the export menu and there'd be Final Cut XML, never AAF. Maybe it's just me, but that was my observation. It's weird how that's the interchange format that people are using. AAF, I guess, is, from what I've heard, I guess it's more complicated or something. It seems to be, like, I know Hero, when it shipped, only shipped with XML. I know Premiere only ships with XML. It's weird that the product that nobody's using anymore is the interchange.
But why do you think that Final Cut owns XML?
I don't. It's just that it seems like that's the format everybody's using, Final Cut XML.
Well, yeah, I mean, they came up with that format for editing. Even though Premiere supports it, it's still not bulletproof because a lot of apps won't actually read Premiere Pro XML. It's slightly different in some apps, depending upon how they're written, on it.
But you know why that is? Because the XML from Final Cut hasn't been updated.
Yep.
So it's whatever it is, 4.6 or 4.7? Yep. And then DaVinci is, for example, one iteration later. So they are getting a problem because the Premiere is... DaVinci's matching XML from Final Cut, and Premiere's exporting one that's one notch later. So we're getting a clash with current DaVinci reading current Premiere, though the new DaVinci 10 should solve that, or the new Premiere will help.
The Flame also has some issues with it too.
What was it that you said the other day? You could only get it opened in Flame and not
EDL. Actually, I have no idea, and I'm actually looking into it. We were so busy right before NAMB, but yeah, I exported EDL. That guy was going very
literally
fast.
Literally, we are going like 80 miles an hour, and somebody passed us like we were just
going over 100.
Yeah. It's got to be like
110. There's a lot of taillights up ahead, so that's not going to work out well for him.
Yeah, but I was prepping some files, actually, for the Hero course, and I haven't looked into it further, but my initial Premiere EDL export didn't work well, and so for Premiere Pro, so I loaded up in Flame, and the stuff did link back. I saved that EDL out of Flame, and that did work. Even though the numbers and stuff were the same, there's some weird subtlety or difference in that file that just caused it to choke.
Well, I've had experiences with that, too, with Avid and Flame, and it's a very sad state that whole business is in.
It's sad that if you want the most bulletproof way of getting it, use an EDL. We talked about this before,
yeah,
but
CMX.
It's just like
1972.
Yes. Yeah, CMX living forever, and but it's kind of pathetic.
That 3600,
actually,
is that right?
There's a lot of times I'll look at the cut and just go, the EDL is going to be a lot easier. You know.
Well, if you have one layer.
Yeah, exactly. It's like I'm not even going to mess with it. Why bother?
But yeah, Premiere's kicking it too. I mean, they've got some nice stuff showing up in the next version of Premiere that's coming out.
I was not a believer when they first came out. I know you were much faster, John. I was like, yeah, you know.
Well, you know, I was a user back when they were with the first editing application on the Mac. Basically, in the days before, I remember when I was in Grand Rapids, Michigan, I believe, on a Mac 2SI or something like that.
Wow.
We were using Premiere. I was using Premiere and After Effects at that time, though After Effects was not part of Adobe at that point. It was COSA After Effects. But yeah, if you saw the launch reveal for Adobe and the new products and looking through Premiere, they made a lot of really nice subtle changes to make things easier. Audio patching is a bit easier, or actually video patching is a bit easier. The way they're just really listening to a lot of feedback from users. You know, things like closed captioning is not a big deal for me, but you can see where they're solidly headed. If they're going to be a force in broadcast editing, obviously you have to do closed captioning.
Well, it's also got the audio...
Oh, the new rules about modulation, whatever it's called, ITU or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
That was impressive. I watched that demo with you, and I was like, wow, that... Because it's been a big topic lately. What do you do about this audio? There's no measurement for it in Flame, for example. And Premiere, you can not only monitor it, but you can set a maximum threshold, and it'll adjust at all to it.
What do you guys think about Creative Cloud?
I think it's been a huge success. You mean the suite of apps?
In respect to our fallen film critic, thumbs up or thumbs down?
You're talking about like the
Creative Cloud concept. Yeah, the idea of getting $30 a month and getting all the apps. And
I'm in it. I love it.
Okay, two-part answer for thumbs up. Baseline, but the subscription fact of just being Creative Cloud, I'm like, sorry, you need to do more with the cloud. We've talked about this before, yeah. You know, and they are doing more. They have sharing, there's stuff that they're adding little by little.
Yeah, I saw that thing where you can drag the Photoshop files in now,
and
they show up as a web browser with layers, switch bottom off, so you can send it to a client.
We know how much we're going to spend each year on the software. You can get all their software products by doing that, which, you know, within other aspects, which is stuff like, you know, book authoring, things like that, HTML design, things like that. That all comes along as part of the Creative Cloud membership, which is really nice. You don't have to worry about, you know, when am I going to have to spend that money for the upgrade? You know, you just understand that you're paying this fee every month and you're going to get whatever new comes out while you have that subscription, which I think is really cool.
Well, also for them, it's got to be a huge win for people ripping off the software by buying one copy and installing it on 20 machines, because, you know, if you're going to license it that way and it's going to check the license, then it's going to not be, you know, you don't have one. I know you get two uses of it, but I remember being in places that they'd have, I'd walk in, not my place, they'd walk in and, you know, someone had bought Photoshop and then installed it on, like, you know, 20 machines. And for a long time, what were you going to do? You know, you weren't literally going to buy 20 licenses. Then they went to, you know, having an enterprise license. But this way, I think it just encourages more people to just own their own copy, as it were.
Well, and plus, you can do short term, right?
Yeah, you could.
It's more expensive, but you can do a shorter term.
Yeah, though I will say sysadmins hate it.
Oh yeah, I'll bet.
It really doesn't work in the model of a post house. I mean, just about every person who has to deal with After Effects Premiere at a larger facility hits their head against the wall dealing with licensing issues.
Because people auto upload to the next version, or
yeah, things like that. But just installing and managing, you can't just set up a centralized license server like you can with a lot of software. Even the, you know, site license stuff that Adobe does, that's also kind of not as effective, obviously.
Thought they were being kind of clever about it in the fact that, you know, I can use it on the plane flying home to Sydney tonight because it doesn't need to check my license every time I use it.
Totally, I agree. I mean, as an individual user, I'm all behind it, but, you know, it's a can of worms for sysadmins to deal with managing large installations, especially if you don't have some special licensing mechanism. And again, they just continually complain about it. You know.
In the presentation, though, they mentioned specifically that there's some new option to make it so sysadmin can make it not auto update or something.
Yes, it's getting better in the next.
So maybe that'll get. Maybe they've gotten a lot of feedback on that, I'm assuming.
Do you guys see that DaVinci Resolve now does live grading as well? So you can have, changing the subject. So you can have DaVinci grading a feed, and then you're there on set, as it were. And then that can get linked back, connected up to the original files when they then get taken back into post. Like, there are a lot of really quite out-of-the-box solutions that people are coming up with for connecting up through kind of metadata and stuff. That's
really cool, Mike. I had no idea, actually. That's a very cool factor.
Yeah. They never had live before. I mean, there's some other stuff hidden in the new DaVinci that I think is really cool. There's a new splitter node that I'm really into that lets you split a shot into, say, RGB or YUV or whatever. So you could do individual channel stuff, but when you hit one button, it makes five nodes. It makes that node, the recombined node, and then the three individual RGB or YUV or whatever you've selected option in the middle. And there's just like 50 new things in that Resolve, and, you know, a lot more sort of things in terms of flexibility of power windows and stuff that you can do. But yeah, the live option I thought was kind of interesting, but I'm it's almost like somebody's come up with something then, and I'm looking forward to seeing how people come to use that, because there will be some innovative uses of it. Do you know what we didn't see a lot of at the show? Stereo.
No.
You're right.
Well, there's an old rule that whatever they show is the big thing this year won't be there next year. So I guess we don't see any 4K next year.
Yeah, that is certainly not a lot of people talking about it. Even it seemed like in the Autodesk booth they weren't talking about it. And we didn't see any of it in our demos at the Foundry booth, did we?
I didn't remember anyone doing stereo.
We were quite busy at times.
Sandy made some jokes about, well, we're glad it wasn't stereo, because they just come off a stereo film and they were doing a music video.
So Jeff, how cool was some of that tech preview and Nuke Hero?
Yeah, I'm so excited to watch. Actually, I'm so bummed that, you know, directing the show, it's really hard to pay total attention to the demo.
Luckily, it's been recorded for you, Jeff.
And plus, it was, you know, on my monitor, it was a smaller size, so I couldn't read the smaller, I couldn't see a lot of the small details, so I'm dying to go back and see it, because I hear the stream is so clear that you can even read the menu items, so I'm really anxious to go back and watch those again, because what I saw, every time I could pause and take a look with the layers and the Nuke X preview and the timeline type stuff and the round trip stuff between Hero and Nuke, I was really impressed.
Yeah, it's literally a Nuke composite graph right in Hero on a shot by shot basis. And someone you asked on the Twitter feed, even, can you do that with two shots to create a complex transition? You have a timeline and you don't want to take two shots to do a blur, zoom, or dissolve thingy. Yeah, you can do that as well. It's not just, you know, so it can span multiple shots within the timeline, not just work on a single clip.
Oh, that's awesome. I didn't see that at all. And, wow.
Yeah, John Waddleton's point, though, is now they have to deliver it.
Yeah, right.
So it's a very early phase. You know, he's like, they just really got that working so they could show it at NAB. So it truly is a tech preview. So it's not coming out next month.
Hero, I got to tell you, I mean, we first saw that at IBC 2 years ago, right? You saw it at SIGGRAPH, I guess.
Yeah, I went over to you.
Yeah, and I saw it first in IBC, and then they shipped it in beta right away, and I started working with it. And, you know, it's totally changed my workflow. I mean, every job I work on now, I most of the time now put the plates online using Hero instead of Flame. There are some times when it makes sense to do some things in Flame. It really depends. You know, for example, I'm on Linux on Hero, so ProRes is kind of out of the question. Things like that. But the advancement that's happened in the short amount of time that Hero's been out, basically a year, I guess. I think they shipped it at NAB last year, right? I think that was the first shipping copy. It's been steady. It's been smart. You know, the biggest problem I think that they have now is just people's expectations. You know, people are asking for things that they're going to get to, but they're being very careful to be, you know, smart about how they update it, you know, and make sure the stuff's really working and really solid. But it's, you know, it's the front part of every job I start now for putting plates online. It's the daily review and conform and playback engine for every job. And it's the final export, you know, the DPXs to then take into Flame and do the client part of and the final delivery part of the job. It's remarkable. I'm truly impressed. And what I saw that preview just takes it to the next level, and you can tell that they're going the right direction, you know? The first thing people start to ask when they see timelines is, oh, can I put a key on this layer? And, you know, they're starting to address that now. So it's exciting. I give them real props for getting this product into shape the way they have.
Yeah, just keep running into Mike Rami as far as I'm at HPA and some places, and, you know, he's really maxed out that pipeline.
Well, that's the thing.
Zoic to allow them to have the VFX producer actually manage dropping shots in the edit and doing exports for people.
Oh, they've got it hooked up to Shot. I see a lot of his emails on it, and he, you know, they've got it integrated to Shotgun. I mean, it's all Python extendable, you know? I mean, we've got it on our render farm.
What I reckon you should do at Digital Domain, to be arrogant and say that, is because the only thing you don't get out of that combination is there's no color correction other than what, you know, you get through color correcting inside Nuke, right? There's no... But
true.
If you add, you know, film light stuff to that and get there, you can grade on the desk and then just have an actual entire virtual version of that inside your Nuke setup as a plugin. And that's pretty powerful. That's the only thing that's missing from that pipeline, right? Because you don't have in the Nuke, in the Foundry product range, a color correction product per se.
Right. It gets complicated because color correction, sometimes you want across the timeline, sometimes you want on individual scenes. And I think that's something that they will need to see what the Foundry decides to do in the pipeline.
But if it's already a plug-in for Nuke, how hard is it to make it a plug-in
it's probably
that
not.
Goes across the timeline in Hero?
Yeah, it's probably not. It's probably not hard at all. It's not a bad idea.
Hey,
it just depends interactivity, you know? It just depends. Right now, one of the things I love about Hero is you can hit play pretty much instantly and it's caching what you've done.
Which, getting back to Resolve, that's got open FX plugins now as well, so it can have Sapphire in your Resolve setting, in your color grade.
So we don't need anamorphic lenses. Kidding.
Always need a lens flare. Yes. Well, but you know, there's a lot of stuff in the Sapphire / you know, open FX kind of plug-in market.
Oh yeah, for sure.
I guess, sorry, go on.
No, plugins are key, and it's also nice if you to see the, speaking of plugins, it's great too to have the optical flares plugin available to new cards.
All the video co-pilot stuff.
Yeah. Andrew's, that's
the
nice
quality of those lens flares, as we were discussing, John, is so high.
Yes.
Yeah, it is. It's really a really very much a nice package. So I think, you know, it's nice it's available for that, because that's a place that you definitely can serve to find use for those.
So I guess we should discuss the elephant in the clean room.
The red booth. Yeah, do you want to tell them? Well, it was funny because I didn't hear about it. I just was walking along, and the red booth is always this dark booth. You can walk across the floor, you look over, and there's like a black hole, because it's the, you know, black carpeting, black walls. It's always very dark. And all of a sudden, I turn the corner, and there's this white room, like totally white, like something out of a science fiction movie. You know, it's like a hospital operating room or something like that. And above it was a big sign, Dragon installs in progress or something like that. So they literally brought part of the clean room or whatever to Vegas. I don't know, it was part of the clean room, the whole clean room, to Vegas, and we're doing...
It would only be a part of their clean room if they were... Yeah, because,
yeah,
I mean,
yeah, small.
Their setup is much bigger than that.
Yeah. But, yeah, I don't know. I never saw anybody actually in there.
Oh, I saw people in there. The thing is, and we discussed this on the FX Guide live show, an actual clean room takes 35 million particles per cubic meter kind of stats and takes it down to 12, not 12 million, 12. Like a clean room has sticky stuff where you walk in, you have the air flows in a way as to create no turbulence. It all moves and sweeps the room. So it's either left to right, where a whole wall is the filter bank, or one, in this case, the top to bottom is the way that this room was designed to laminar fill the room down with stuff that would suck and sweep the room from airflow point of view. So to build one of those on the show floor of NAB is just out of, I mean, it's almost incomprehensible. So the question was it a real clean room or not? I mean, it certainly looked like a real clean room, and it had real gear in it, and they had lots of epics in there. The question was, were they actually 100% completely... And I guess at some point, it didn't really matter, right? Because the point of the clean room is we're doing Dragon upgrades, and it's real. And if they hadn't had the clean room, we'd all be sitting here now going, bloody Dragon, announced it 2 years ago, said, you know, with a tattoo parlor. Last year said it was really close, and this year they've still not got Dragons. So, you know, it's vaporware. But they said, yes, Dragon is real. Look, here's the clean room. We're putting them in right now, right here at the show floor. And go online to, you know, get your place in the queue, which is, depending on whether you want an M or you're an early adopter of a Red 1, will mean it costs you $8,500 or $9,500. And by the time you're listening to this, if you haven't got your order in, it's open to the general public now, and you're in the sort of general... You open on Thursday to anyone who wants to, even if they're a, sort of a normal user.
If somebody's not hip, what's the Dragon big difference?
Oh, I'm sorry. The Dragon sensor is an upgrade from the 5K Epic MX sensor to a chip that is 6K, has vastly increased dynamic range and a better noise floor that should take the base ISO up from 800 to at least a stop, or maybe two above that. So if it was at 800 now, you'd be like at 2000, it's kind of a standard ISO, which means you can operate in more low light conditions, you have higher dynamic range, and you have bigger files. I'm not so up for the 6K, I don't know why I need to go to 6K, but I definitely think the dynamic range is great, and the better ISO is also, I mean, they really need to do both of those things. And having better dynamic range is one of the things that made ARRI, that and its sort of ProRes onboard recording, so popular with DOPs. And apart from that, they also were not shipping or showing the projectors, which again is a shame because we expected that from last year. So they haven't dropped the projector, but the Red Ray really doesn't become a valid, I mean, it's a playback device without a projector. It's sort of like a bit of an island here. What are you going to play it into? I guess you can play it into 4K monitor grids, but it's, you know, the Red Ray with a red projector becomes a really powerful game changer. So not having the projector there was a big shame, and that'll probably be the end of the year, but they're so not close to shipping it that they're not even talking about it. So I was disappointed in that.
Yeah, and that's something that's really, obviously, you know, in today's world with the trade shows, you know, you find out so much stuff online, especially with software-based products. You know, the projector is one thing, one of the real benefits of going is to see something like that, and that was kind of a shame.
That's a good point.
Yeah. They also had a global shutter, which is interesting. So the global shutter sits in front of the current shutter. So you can mount it on any camera that you've got from Red that has a PL mount right now, though it's going to be an EF mount as well. And so this thing puts an LCD in front of the current shutter so as to give you global instead of rolling shutter, but at the price of one stop because it's an LCD electronic. You know those things you've seen in like hotels or bathrooms where you press the glass and it goes opaque?
Yep.
It's that kind of tech, which costs you a stop. The trouble is the whole point of going to the Dragon for $10,000 is to get you one of those three things, which is an extra stop or so, right? So then you lose it again if you then go put the global shutter in.
But they made it switchable, right? So if you don't need, if you don't have a rolling shutter problem, if you're shooting a shot that doesn't have a rolling shutter problem, you could switch it off in theory. But it doesn't
And also acts as a variable ND. But yeah, but it is a shame to lose a stop, though. I mean, obviously you can't have anything for free, but I'm pretty sure that a lot of DOPs will be like, I don't care about the rolling shutter, I just want the stop. A lot of VFX people might say, I really want the rolling shutter free vision, and I don't care what put up all lights.
I guess it's a good option if you have to shoot a paparazzi scene or something with lots of flash bulbs.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, guns as well. We saw at 3210, the guns were producing flash lines that were across the rolling shutter that weren't very nice at all.
That's a very good point.
And there is a Red Rocket 2.
Five times the performance?
Roughly, yeah. It's mainly designed for 6K type work. That's where it's really going to come into its own. But as I was saying earlier, like, I really like Premiere, and if you can get a good CUDA card, John, and get some good RAM, you can be editing on an HD timeline with R3D files without using a Red Rocket, and it's going to play back fine, and you can edit fine. I think the non-Red Rocket workflows for people that aren't doing, you know, stereo high-end feature stuff is becoming better and better, and I love what they're doing with CUDA.
Yeah, they've really optimized the CPU processing for the R3Ds in Premiere because to make that happen, so not actually using, I mean, so you get really optimized debayering at your target resolution within Premiere, and then you're, like I said, you're using the GPU to do the color and other stuff on top of that. It's kind of a really nice mix the way it works in Premiere.
Sorry, I think that's spectacularly good. That Premiere workflow for R3D files is kind of my new fave thing. You going off-road, Jeff?
No, sorry. The nav is trying to take us the wrong way.
But yeah, I mean, I think, again, I think you're right about Premiere. It's a really smart, and, you know, again, you do your standard stuff in the CPU, and then you can do your creative filters and things like that using the GPU, and it does a nice divide. That's not always the case in other software applications, right? They're doing it all in the CPU or something like that, and they just don't get the performance out of it.
Well, but the 6K thing is a real question, though. I mean, because people in their head tend to think, well, I don't need 6K, I'll just shoot it at 5K, but you really don't do that on the Red because your window. So,
we do it on all the time. We shoot 4K on the Red instead of 5K because we want 4K HD, and we just take a step back with the camera.
But you're losing. Yeah, right.
And I think that also in the case of the 6K, it's a wider field of view. Excuse me. So I don't have to take a step back, right? Because if I was standing here on my Epic without a Dragon, I can stand on the same spot with my Dragon Epic, now cropped to 5K, and it's going to look the same as it was a moment ago. That 6K gives me a wider field of view.
Right.
So Jason Wingrove's going to want to shoot on 6K just because he wants full sensor, as it were.
I mean, it's one of the things I
closer to full sensor.
It's just one of the things I run into a lot is people forgetting that when you change the res on the red, it's not like you're
It's going to down window down. Well, I mean, you really notice it in 2K, right? But you get this super cut out middle bit of your picture.
Yeah. And you better have wide angle lenses.
I think, I really think I would be personally putting my hand up for a Dragon upgrade and not putting my hand up for a Red Rocket 2. Not least of which, because the Red Rocket 2 in my workflow in Sydney, which is Mac based, has to go into an old Mac tower. So if I don't have a new Mac tower,
right.
I'm sort of not really wanting to spend nearly $10,000 for a Mac tower plug-in.
Well, the good thing is the old Red Rocket still works. It's going to be slower, but you know, I can see the Red Rocket, the new Red Rocket card. If you're in a, if you're a DIT or if you're in that quick turnaround world where you have to do it, sure, it's a no-brainer, I guess.
Yeah, stereo workflow.
Yeah, you got to pump out, stereo stuff right away. And yeah, I don't think I'd recommend updating in my world right now.
Yeah, not if you have one already.
No, if you have one already.
Yeah, that's for sure.
It's frightening to me, though, that we came to NAB, I'm going to say 2 years ago, maybe it was three, and the thing that we were talking about in the car going back was Final Cut X. Wasn't released. We'd been to the Super User, which used to be the Final Cut Super Meet, right? I think that's actually what it was called. Apple turned up and showed this stuff, and we all sat on the floor, and it was an auditorium the size of a planet, and it was packed to the rafters. Yep. And we were like, oh my God, this is just awesome. And here we are, whatever that is, 2 years, maybe three later, going, I didn't see a single Final Cut screen up around NAB. There was no Apple booth. No one was talking about Final Cut other than John's report. Jeff's went about XMLs. And yet we were voting it the most interesting thing we saw at the show.
Wow. Yeah, and it's, again, one of those releasing things early. You know, it seems like at that point, when they initially released their product, the first version, it was missing so much stuff that they're having a tough time getting that back, that perception back. And they have made advancements within that time, within the software. But it just, it shouldn't...
People had to make decisions before that.
Yeah.
Although I will have a little different take on this. I was talking to a friend of mine, Bern Wilbert, who listens to the RC religiously. And we were talking after
what's
the
podcast.
Vernon Wilbert.
Hey, Vernon.
Great guy, director, visual effects supervisor.
I've always liked Vernon.
Yes. He shoots a lot of personal projects. And we were just talking after the discussion you and Jason had about Premiere and all that kind of stuff. And he's all over Premiere. He loves Premiere. But he tends to want to do the creative part. And he's a big Lightroom user. And he really likes the fact that you can do all this tagging and metadata stuff in Lightroom. And he started getting really frustrated in Premiere. Finding clips and finding shots, and so he thought, you know what, I'm going to go back and open up Final Cut Pro. It's been updated X. It's been updated a few times and try it. And he said, not for editing, not for finishing, not for anything else, but for as a creative, just sitting down and forgetting about the tools and sketching together the shots and kind of putting things in order and trying things. He just found it was more like the old days of Apple where things melt away and you just do the work. Just focus on the images and worry about the work.
I mean, I'm incredibly impressed you found a Final Cut X user at NAB.
No, this is before.
Oh, okay. Well, then.
We were just talking about workflow and stuff. I know, but I'm just saying. His take on it was just interesting. He said then he takes the finish, and there's a great plug-in to move stuff back to Premiere in both directions, I guess. But it's just a different take. It's like thinking about the different tools. It's kind of like the first time I ever opened up iMovie. I was like, this is horrible. And then I realized in about 15 minutes I'd finished what I was going to try to do. That would have taken me a lot longer in any other package. And they fixed a lot of the problems. I mean, I'm not saying it's over. I mean, I'm sorry, it's over. They're going after a different market
still
than we're
going.
In. But it's still, it does. It may have its uses, and it may be that they're, that in the long run, there's more people shooting imagery than ever before. So having different varieties of tools available, that may not be the professional market is not a, or the, the finishing market may not be a bad thing, is my only point.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard that. I mean, I've seen that too, actually. I've seen a lot of people posting that. You know what? I tried it again, and I actually do like this quite a bit based upon what they've done in the past. I mean, for me, I don't have the time to learn yet another piece of software, especially one that I'm currently happy with, and that's Premiere.
Right. Yeah. So. Well, and I like the thing I love about Premiere is that you can just, the interoperability with everything else. It's like, you know, the interoperability with Audition and After Effects, and just seamless.
Here are my things that I wish, though, just as we're talking about Premiere, wish I had seen in the next version of stuff that they are introducing. A good color managed workflow between their applications. You know, yeah. Rec 709 and Premiere, really. Getting to After Effects and getting to SpeedGrade. You should have the same color management, display color management in all those apps at this point. I'm sorry.
Would the SpeedGrade feel like a fully Adobe product?
Not yet. No, not yet. They did some nice improvements in the UI, some nice changes to make it more accessible. But, yeah, I mean, it's like, God, they have all those products. Let's get it together so when you look at an image in SpeedGrade, it looks like it does in Premiere. After Effects Premiere is really brutal right now still in certain situations for that. And I was hoping in discussions of what we talked about almost a year ago with them personally that I was going to see that in this version. So I was kind of somewhat disappointed. Actually, I was disappointed that that wasn't part of this release between those applications. The other one is, frankly, between SpeedGrade and Premiere. I'm sorry. Let's not render everything into a DPX sequence to open it up and then have to bring it back in. Let's work with the same exact timeline in SpeedGrade as we are in Premiere. Now, I understand that's not going to happen now. I mean, that these are two total different code bases, actually three, After Effects and Premiere, but they're slowly changing some of that architecture under the hood.
But you're right, rendering it all out same. Is like mad.
I'm like, or the other option, EDL. You know, it's like we're back to what we were talking about earlier in. But so those are some things. I mean, I don't mean, because I think it's a really substantial release that they're talking about with the, you know, production package After Effects Premiere. But the couple things that I saw that I wish they actually had in those, I was like, oh, man. Especially color management. I think actually just display color management, project color management. That's a big one.
We were saying that we thought that there might be a Mac new tower release sometime, and I really still believe there will be, not least which because Cook said there was going to be, and they have to, I think, for a bunch of reasons. But some of the other rumors that didn't pan out, which we don't normally discuss rumors, so I think it's okay to discuss them after we're disproving them. The one that I heard quite strongly going into NAB, which I kept an eye out for, which was completely not true, was that Blackmagic was going to buy Avid. Did you hear that one?
Yeah.
So that didn't happen.
Somebody said next year.
Someone posted Flame on Mac, I didn't know, but I could almost guarantee that was going to happen. Maybe Flare could be an insensible thing to run on a Macintosh system, but you know, without the display card that you have, it doesn't sound Flame-like to me. You know, without having big beefy graphics that are fast, it's just not working on the Mac platform.
Yes. While we're on that, though, we touched on it just a second ago. It makes a big difference for our workflow if you can get a CUDA card in a MacBook Pro, which you can, but you couldn't before. And you've got it, and I have it, and I'm envious.
Yes, it makes a huge difference. The ray tracing in After Effects is still a bit brutal, even on the Retina. It's just not beefy enough compared to the 5000 I have in the tower. But it makes a huge difference in Premiere for sure. You would love it even more.
Yes, I would. Say, you know. I would love it a lot. I'm sure I would. There are quite a lot of things I would love it for, because there's a lot of software now that is just proving NVIDIA has what it takes to deliver in our market. I mean, did you guys go to the NVIDIA booth? I mean, they had some pretty impressive demos up there, but I guess nothing compared to what you would have seen, John, at the GTC.
Yeah, that's what
GTC.
I was just going to say. Yeah, I love their roadmap. It's not obvious when the articles that I put online. I think they have a very sensible roadmap, though. You know, the former, the AMD ATI, the Fire, they're doing some nice work as well on the graphics side. They're not as prevalent in evangelizing CUDA processing and so forth, but they're competitors to NVIDIA, and they're putting out some nice hardware that's usable for really beefy cards.
Yeah. Did anyone see, I saw an outside, what looked like a shade area for Quantel. That was about it.
Oh, where the race car used to park?
Yeah.
Oh, that's right. I didn't see it. There was a booth. I saw a sign somewhere.
Was there?
I didn't go there, but I thought I saw a sign over the top of another booth.
We were walking.
I think it was across from where we were at the Foundry and Autodesk. And
God, Canon had a big booth this year.
Yeah. I thought it was really amusing walking in. It dawned on me on Tuesday as I walked in the show. As we, you know, got there early before the show opened. And I'm like, I was transported back in time to an NAB where there's this giant Grass Valley booth at the entrance to the show.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
and
yeah,
a couple booths down, Abacus.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, and a huge Autodesk booth.
Yes.
And a huge Apple booth.
Yeah.
Yes. Remember, Apple used to have a whole lot of computers out the front. You could sit down and kind of do tutorial stuff there.
So it was interesting to see those two manufacturers back again and on the show floor.
Did DaVinci? Blackmagic? I guess they got that space because of the DaVinci seniority at that. Because I know it's a whole big pecking order to get where the booth spaces are.
I think that's changed a bit because I don't think there's quite the demand that there used to be. And I think that if you want that much space, I think you get elevated pretty quick these days.
Well, yeah, I think that's what I heard, is that they take that space, because the booth is kind of split in half. It's the hugest, it's got to be the biggest booth.
Oh, maybe. It's such a fuck-off thing that they do.
And they split it off.
Yeah, we're going to leave a whole section out the back. We're so rich and so successful. We leave a whole section out the back just so you can hang around and have meetings without anyone bothering you.
AJA could do that if they didn't spend, what, $500,000 on a party every year at NAB. I mean, I went to that party last night, and I just... baffles me how much money must go through on that party that they spend. It's huge.
Yeah, you know, you make money when you...
That's expensive enough to do the trade show.
So
is it really a $500,000 party? No, really?
Oh, $100,000 easily.
Wow.
I mean, Mike, our giveaway, our small one at NAB...
Yeah, that's true.
It was 20,000 or something.
Yeah,
like
that's
that.
True.
Yeah,
so that's the fortune. So
that's why it dawned on me. I'm like, wow. So.
By the way, we had sponsors. We didn't spend your money on
that.
We don't throw $20,000 parties for ourselves.
Yeah. What was I going to say? Yeah, but so, that's probably where Blackmagic spends their money. But there is actually a pecking order, and it's based upon also how much time and what your history is, how big your booth is, that you get priority in the lottery system. And they do have this thing that over time you develop priority based upon what you spend.
Yeah, which is why Ultimat can go anywhere they want, right?
Yes,
they've got
exactly.
So many history points. Yeah. I didn't get down the back of the South Hall much, but I got down the back of the Central Hall, because the Central Hall these days with camera tech moving so quickly is one of the most interesting halls to be in, and that's where Wooden Camera was. And we were saying before, I think, how much we enjoyed the Wooden Camera stuff we had on our booth, because they were sponsoring us. That's where Miller was, who was also sponsoring us. Rode was sponsoring us, but they weren't there. That both Wooden Camera and Miller had booth presences. But Wooden Camera, Jeff, you were saying thought it was really comfortable.
Well, that was the kind of stuff that... I mean, I've seen the Wooden Camera stuff before, but that was the first time when we went to film the segment for the TV show. The first time I'd gotten to play with it and actually use one of the rigs. And I was really impressed by how comfortable it was and the attention to detail on how everything works and everything's interoperable between different pieces. It just... I've seen a lot of rigs, and I just really was impressed with theirs. And I especially like the leather handles. I thought that was a nice touch.
Isn't that nice? Yeah. Yeah, I really like those guys. They've come along in leaps and bounds. Their A-Box, which is an audio breakout box.
Oh, that was the first thing, right?
That's what we got first from them. I mean, I bought that for the Epic, and it was just rock star quality. And that then for the Blackmagic camera. And I think that's still one of their biggest sellers today. Yeah, no, they're good guys. But there's a lot of stuff in that South Hall.
I love the South Hall.
The Central Hall.
I was going to try to go there on the way back to the hotel Monday night. And instead, we were at the Las Vegas, the LVH, I guess it's called now, the Las Vegas Hilton. No longer the Hilton. Anyway, I walked through the Central Hall, and I just got sucked in because there's just so much cool stuff to go look at over there. A couple things I saw over there that I just didn't, the kind of stumble upon stuff. I knew Benro was making a bunch of new tripods, but they have a... John, you know that monopod you had with the feet?
Yeah.
Benro makes one now. And it's $199 with the head.
Really?
And it's like... I think it's actually a little nicer in some ways than the...
Head?
No. Well, it's a... the lightweight fluid head. For like a stills camera or something. You can put a 7D on top of it, and on top of a monopod, it'd be totally fine. Or a 5D, I mean. Sorry.
You know Miller, the Australian company, invented fluid heads, right?
They did.
Just a little Aussie kind of proud thing there.
Well, I thought that was pretty amazing.
The Bloomin' Onion.
So what was that?
The Bloomin' Onion. Wow. But yeah. I thought that was a pretty amazing price point. Their tripods.
You invented boy bands. So fuck off.
I think that was Britain, wasn't it?
The
other thing I found over there was.
Now they just perfected them.
One of the things that caught my eye was I walked by the Moll Richardson booth, and the first thing that caught my eye was they had a really creepy dummy behind the desk. And
wasn't that weird?
I was walking by, like, why would you do that? It caught my attention. I guess that's why they did it. But
they're
they had
about it.
I know that's true. But they, but I stopped for a second. I was looking because I noticed they had a, you know, the little baby light.
Yeah.
And they had a mod kit for it for a whole bunch of their lights now to convert them to LED. And it was like $1,300. You replace the Fresnel and you put this box on the bottom and obviously the bulb. For the baby, I think that was the price around there.
Couldn't reuse the same.
Use the same fixture
lens.
No, they have to change the lens for some reason. And I asked him because I know you're fussy about your LED lights.
I am fussy about my LED lights.
He said it's within 10% tolerance of the traditional light.
Okay, well that's not very good, is it?
Well, I don't know.
Well, it depends where you measure 10%, I guess.
I don't know if it's color, temperature, brightness. I don't know what the answer to that is.
No, but if your color index is, you want to, 91, 92, 93 would be ideal, right? So if you're 10% off that, you're down at 80-something, right? Well, I want better than 80.
Well, I'm not sure it was color. It might have been brightness. It might have been intensity. I don't know.
Okay.
We should probably find out more about that. But I just thought it was interesting. I thought it was like instead of just buying a new fixture, you could actually retrofit your old fixtures to be LED, which... I don't know. I thought that was interesting. You could also buy new fixtures that are already LED.
Yes.
I didn't look at a lot of LED lights this year. I didn't, you know. It seemed like that had calmed down a little bit. Like maybe the lawsuit thing calmed that down a little bit, but...
They're certainly getting better, and they are inherently a good idea. You just need to get a good one implemented well by a company. I like Dito lights a lot, if you hadn't noticed that. They're really good. I don't know if we've got a Dito FX Guide TV up, and the guy is just a legend. You should check that out. It's at fxguide.com, of course. Was there anything else that you like were disappointed with at the show? Was there anything you went, oh, come on, really? That's lame? Did you struggle with anything lame, John?
The internet at the hotel. But no, no, I didn't, you know, I think... I didn't really run into anything like that. I mean, we had a short time there. I probably had a total of 3 hours on the show floor, all was said and done. Basically consumed, you know, the things that I saw offline or online to go and check them out. But no, I didn't think about that. But no, I didn't see anything that was especially lame.
I saw a lot of 4K displays, proudly displayed, that I walked up to and looked at and went, eh, I don't care. It didn't blow me away. It didn't make me crazy. I saw a couple that made me go, wow, that's incredible. Really bright, really crisp, really clear, and all with the most amazing demo footage you've ever seen. You know, the Chinese dancing dragons and stuff like that that are just so colorful and bright and broad daylight. But I was kind of surprised how unimpressed I was with some of the 4K displays. I wasn't looking at them in great detail, but I didn't walk in and have go like, wow, my socks have been blown off. I did see something really cool, though, I forgot, in the
yeah,
south hall. The Atomos. Atomos?
Isn't that one in the central hall?
Yeah, the central hall. I'm sorry. Yeah, ATMOS. ATOMOS.
Yep.
They make the little monitors with the built-in SSD drives, so it's kind of your recorder and your Asia box built into your monitor, basically. Same idea. There's a bunch of companies doing that, right? But they had a... It caught my eye because I walked up and there was a 5D Mark III there.
So did they make the Ninja?
They make the Ninja, yeah. Yep.
But is this the Ninja 2 you're looking
at? Ninja 2.
Because yep. The Ninja 1 had some major problems. Build
oh, really?
Quality.
Okay. Well, I walked over and I saw the 5D Mark III on the table and it had an LCD monitor on top of it. That's what caught my eye because I noticed that the HDMI was on and the LCD screen was on. And I'm like, well, that doesn't work that way.
Right.
Plug in the HDMI, the back of the screen shuts off.
Yep.
So I'm like, well, that's odd. So I'm talking to the guy, and I said, excuse me, but how are you doing that? And he goes, oh, we're on the pre-release of the new firmware for the camera.
That was showing the beta.
And I went, really? And he goes, yeah, it's really cool. Let me show you. And he picks up the camera, and he hits the record button, and the Ninja started recording, which I was not expecting that. I don't know why. It just didn't think to me that that would work in that implementation. So stop and start happened while you're recording to your internal card. It was recording to the Ninja through an uncompressed HDI with clean without any burn-ins. So that was pretty cool to see that in person and see that they're gonna, if they can leave the same screen on, the LCD if you want it. And I did confirm that. They sent a press release out saying they were showing a special with permission from Canon to show
them. Oh, they had permission, right? They accidentally
laid it out. And somebody in the on the Twitter thought that maybe it might be the, you know, Magic Lantern or something like that, but that they confirmed that it was the Canon pre-release of that software. So that was encouraging. I don't know how I feel about that, but it was a nice little clean package. The picture quality was not quite what you'd expect out of like a Marshall or a small HD or something like that. But they did have a new one called, like, I think it was called Samurai Blade, which is, they had it next to a red, the original red viewfinder, LCD, and it looked very nice.
So, John, you know, we were talking before about betas and stuff.
Yeah.
So I went to a lecture, and they were talking about what had happened in the morning. So I don't want to name names because I don't want to get in trouble, but literally what had happened is that, and this is said publicly to the audience in the NAB, so I'm only repeating that, they'd had planned to show a lot more beta stuff from Adobe, and so these people that were doing lectures on the Saturday and Sunday had prepared their lectures using the beta software, and then an email went out at the last minute saying, oh, you can't use the new, you need to use CS6, and not what they were jokingly referring to, I think, as CS Next. Anyway, some of the people that were traveling didn't get the memos or the emails because they were literally traveling. And so on the morning of the NAB, they were doing their lectures with the CS Next, only to have a bunch of Adobe people running around afterwards saying, nope, you need to switch it. So all the people in the afternoon had to, over lunch, have rejigged their demos to use the morning from, because some of them were repeated from the morning. And some of them were continuations, like, you know, part one and part two. And they were saying, yeah, so stuff I showed you this morning, I can't continue with that bit. But I'll show you this other bit.
Wow, that's bad.
Because I didn't read my emails when I got off the plane, and it was one of those, somebody thought, well, we'll just stop everybody before they get there, but they haven't quite thought through the implementation. Now, I don't know that, other than I was told firsthand by sitting in the audience by the presenter that that's what happened, but it sounds plausible. But yeah, it was...
Oops.
So if you went to the morning sessions, you got a good demo rundown of CS Next, and some of the new features, and in the afternoon you didn't.
Wow.
Yeah, I wonder if there are any things that you could have spotted in there that they haven't talked about in their press.
Unfortunately, I was only at the afternoon session, so I didn't have the advantage of the morning sneak peek. But yeah, I think there is certainly things like Premiere Anywhere that have been discussed, and we're not expecting... We're expecting that to still be Premiere, right? Just done on a remote kind of platform rather than a, you know, brand new UI kind of thing. So, but yeah, it was interesting to see that there was... Certainly there was one particular point they were mentioning that they weren't allowed to continue discussing.
Well, they did actually, Anywhere, they did release all the hardware information, you know, what it's qualified on, which was, you know, Dell rack units, rack systems, PowerEdge, Hewlett-Packard. It only runs on Windows 2008 Server Enterprise.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
For the hub, for the collaboration hub, which is where all the data is stored, and then for the streaming engine where all the rendering is done, that's also running Windows 2008 with, you know, requiring a 10G, you know, Ethernet adapter and then a Tesla K10 card. That's the recommended... a qualified system, so definitely you'll need a Windows system in house if you're going to utilize this. The upcoming Adobe Anywhere that will apparently ship whenever.
But my remote satellite stations can be Mac.
Exactly, yeah. This is the server main central Hertz server hardware that runs that. I couldn't find any kind of price. There's no pricing, or at least none that we could find at this point regarding that. But basically give some insight into what's happening under the hood with that Anywhere package.
So if you wanted to get media up onto that in a hurry, you'd have to be local to it, obviously.
Yes.
But in theory, the idea was that you could be cutting and background uploading, too, if you had a fast pipe, I guess?
Yes,
I guess
that
we don't know
possible.
All the details. But
yes, that's certainly in the pre-release or preview that we saw, that was the case.
Right, okay.
Feels like an equipment room with remote stations to me.
Yeah.
Well, our flames never had the flame in the room. They were out in the equipment room. It's like the same principle, right? Except for...
NVIDIA also, you know, you brought that up, and I wrote an article about this NAT appliance, and if you didn't see the article, you might worry about it. It's a grid VCA, virtual computing appliance, which is basically a plug-and-play unit that has a bunch of Quadro cards in it, and you can have your artist, you know, log into the server and get a virtual desktop session utilizing this hardware. So basically, they don't have any computer hardware at their desk necessarily. Well, actually, they have not heavy duty, but you're basically running applications on this grid server. It's probably like a 6-rack unit high unit. And so if you had multiple people, say, doing Maya or something like that, they could run off the system. And it started me thinking that, you know, that could be a slick way, while not designed and ready at this point, that could be a slick way of a virtual production company where you had artists working off-site. If you had them all logging into this computer in their centralized location working on it, actually know that, you know, the idea behind this is the VCA makes it easy for people to do this. You know, it's plug and play, but I certainly know that there are various effects facilities doing that kind of stuff already between their various facilities. You know, they have their machines in the main office and then working externally somewhere else.
I've heard of companies doing that with flames.
Yeah.
You know, having the flames themselves in Los Angeles, and the artist in Vancouver is using them from there or from other cities.
That blows my mind.
I mean, you know...
I know they're doing it, right? They're doing it in Vancouver and LA. But
years ago, I had an engineer friend who used to do that with the Harry and Henry's. He put in high-speed lines, because it's the same principle. You basically only have to get back, and the Quantel was even easier, because you really only had to get back one, since all the menus were overlaid on the on the video, you only had to get back one display line in real time, so you just get a broadcast line back then, I guess, and then you just had to have some data channels to get the commands across. You'd think there'd be such a delay in all the, running a pen, you'd think there'd be delays, and it'll drive you nuts.
Yeah.
Latency, that's the word I'm looking for.
Because you'd want no latency on drawing.
Exactly, or stopping the play button, you'd think that, but I don't know, apparently it works. I don't know, I just think that seems to be where we're heading with a lot of this cloud stuff. Is I think that Adobe Anywhere, I think, is going to, that same concept of, pushing down the information to you just through one display line and letting the heavy lifting being done on a bigger computer might be...
Slick, because they're not using, you're not doing the whole UI on Anywhere. You're just doing whatever resolution you need for that one window that you have up currently within the application, right? It's just the only thing that's being, data that's being streamed in 30 frames per second as you're playing is that small image window within the player viewer. It could be larger, obviously, if you had an external monitor. But yeah, I certainly see that grid computing and having, it would be nice. I mean, you could have, when these virtual appliances, like from NVIDIA, if you could assign the number of CPUs and assign multiple graphics cards to a given user, that's where it becomes interesting, right? Because you can have more horsepower for someone who needs it, right? Right now it's a one-to-one and you can't do anything, but they'll be changing that in the future. But it just dawned on me that that's a really, this remote workflow or off-site workflow where you're working on some really strong hardware, but you're wherever. Totally,
it's that
different
atomic fiction model you've talked about up there, right?
With the,
but I will say, I talked to a friend of mine who's a supervisor who's done quite a bit of extensive testing into that, and he said he could not make the business model work. He just could not, under any circumstance, with any of the systems or making special relationships, make it work financially. So I'm curious. On a large scale.
Yeah, I think it would be very difficult.
Hey, we mentioned it on the TV show, but there was a little turmoil in Vegas while we were there, which was unusual. Never seen quite the display of that in Vegas before. We've had, for years, the Frontier, I think it was, hotel used to have picketers, like literally for 20 years they had picketers every time you went. But this time they
were... What was that?
They had a long-standing dispute with management of the hotel, and I mean, I swear, 20 years they were out there in front of that hotel. I could never figure out how that worked, but...
They tore down the hotel.
Yeah, they did, eventually, yes, indeed. But as you went to leave the convention center, most nights there was a very large, very loud, blowing whistles contingent of taxi drivers. Taxis were on strike. Now, not all of them. There were two main companies in disputes, and Mike and I talked to one of the cab drivers last night and got a little bit of his background on that. But it was just interesting to see the...
Well, you said, right, this is one of the biggest trade shows of the year, so for the taxi drivers to not do fares for that...
Yeah, I mean, this is there's top five shows, I'm sure, in Vegas is NAB, and it's the time to make money as a cab driver. So, you know, it's to give up the income to be out on the picket line, the issues must be pretty severe. So, and having been involved in the not quite as, you know, against an action, against a... employer type action with the protest in Hollywood, I really had a lot of empathy for them out there on the street with the signs and whistles. And but it was interesting. I had heard at one point that, you know, they had stopped picking up, all the cabs had stopped picking up from the convention center. I don't think that was really true, but
there were very few the other night.
We were loading up last night around 6 o'clock.
Oh yeah, the lines outside the hotels were really bad. I mean,
yeah,
the limo drivers were making out like bandits, just, you know, snarking people for a little bit more than cab or double cab fares.
They really need Uber in Las Vegas.
Yeah, if they put the monorail... The irony to me about this whole thing is I think the cab drivers fought to keep the monorail from in front of the hotels on the Strip. So the monorail took a lot less... If you can imagine the monorail running down the Las Vegas Strip, it would have been such a more tourist attraction and very scenic, and, you know, everybody would want to ride it. But instead... I understand that the cab companies fought really hard. Maybe I have this wrong, so I should stop. But to put it behind the hotels, it makes it really uncomfortable to get from the train to the hotels. In most of the hotels, it's like the furthest away point from the back of the hotel.
What a genius move to decide to stay once again close to the convention center in hindsight.
Yeah.
Good idea with it this week.
This week? Yeah, I think I took one cab the whole week while I had the car. So.
Well, I took more than one, but yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, but the cab line outside the LVH, I still can't get used to that, was large every night when we came in or went out.
One thing I also just really quickly want to thank the guys again who helped us out on the netcast.
Oh yeah,
the streaming netcast. It was really, had a great crew, a lot of people helping us out. Really fantastic, from Ryan and Chelsea and David and Jimmy, who's here in the car with us now, to our volunteers as well. Big thanks to them, because it's a lot of people be behind the scenes putting it on, as well as the support from the Foundry and the other sponsors.
And really big thanks to you guys for listening and for watching. We had record numbers on the stream. We had a lot of people posting they really enjoyed the quality of the videos, which meant that they could actually see what was going on, for example, on the menus when a nuke demonstration was on. If you didn't see the stream, it is actually looping. The looping is finished by the time you listen to this podcast, we will be cutting parts up and putting it online for later download. Depends when, of course, you're listening.
And it was interesting, a little behind-the-scenes action. We had been, you know, testing this, obviously, before we got here, and we arrived on Saturday and set up on Sunday on the booth, and they were streaming it back to us at the hotel, and we were looking, wow, that looks really, really great. And same thing Monday. We were hooking up Monday night. It was all working great. And then, of course, you know, probably 15 minutes before we're ready to go on the air, Ryan starts noticing that the internet bandwidth is going seriously down, to the point at which it looked briefly like, yeah, there was no way we were going to be on the air at 10. And luckily, Willem, who works with Foundry, basically yanked everyone else off the net, turned off the wireless, and plugged us directly into the feed.
Well, we got saved by our own preparedness, really, because we were so far ahead and everything was working so well that we decided to do a little teaser for the people that were, you know, sitting there waiting, watching the stream diligently. So we thought we'd do a little, you know, 15-second, hey, how are you? Stand by, we're getting ready here, we're still setting up. And we did that, and the bandwidth meter went from peaked to nothing. And that didn't go out.
Can I just say that this was a West Wing moment for me? If you've seen West Wing, there's a bit where he's going to do his talk for the debate, and he said, I just don't have my lucky tie. Remember last year I had to, last time I was doing this, to getting elected, and somebody spilled something on my tie and I had to put one at the last minute, and it was a race to get to the stage, and it just caused a lot of juice. And this year they're all really well organized, and so suddenly out of the blue his wife cuts his tie to cause more commotion, to cause more energy, so that when he goes out on stage he has that juice. And I felt like you were doing that again. It was like, last time we were really hyped because we nearly lost it all at the last second, so let's just almost lose it all again at the last second.
I felt more like the scene in Broadcast News, where she's running with the tape and she's smacking her head into the file cabinets.
She doesn't. She skids under it.
Oh, that's right.
Because she
I felt like I smacked my head. So we did three of those teases trying to figure out what was going on. And I think one of them went out finally. And when we figured out this switch, Willem figured out the best reconnect of the whole system to.
So you did not see John and I's incredibly great comic bits.
Yes. They're left on the streaming floor, I guess.
The streaming cutting room floor.
Yeah.
I never saw my performance to a. Sorry.
The great bit bucket, sorry.
Which one went out? Was it the Beastie Boys one or the?
I think it was the that was the third one. I think Beastie Boys was number two. Yeah, exactly.
Thunder from Down Under.
It was the Cirque du Soleil one, I think.
The Cirque du Soleil one, right? With or without the pole?
Okay. Well, we're heading back into traffic. We should probably sign off. Let Jeff concentrate on driving before we end up in the hospital.
Yeah, yeah. We're about to cross from the 10 where it turns into the
car park.
No, sadly.
No, I meant the, you know, 405.
Oh, yes, yes, it's true. Oh, what time is it? Oh, it's early enough. Hopefully we'll be okay. But anyway, yeah.
Having had hour-long commutes across L.A. The last week when I was working in L.A. because somebody broke down on the 405, boy, that's fun.
This is the Californians you're listening to.
Yeah, exactly.
No, the 405 is, you know, as we all, anybody who lives in L.A. knows, it's like, it's my kryptonite. It's like I try to avoid it like the plague.
This is turning into a Saturday Night Live skit.
It is.
Talking about the highways in L.A.
All right. Well, I'm going to go catch a plane and go home. So having got up really early and traveled all the way from Vegas, I'm now going to sit on a plane for 14 and a half hours staring at my iPad. So
I'm going to go home and catch some shut-eye because I was out at the AJ. Hey, you know what? And a big thanks to the crew from the Foundry.
Who saved you from...
saved me from my own...
No, saved the other guy from you pounding him like a hamburger meat. There's some guy out there that today who was drunk that has not got a broken nose because the Foundry pulled my man John out of, like, defending in that AJA party fight.
Yeah,
and so if you are that dickhead, you mess with John, you mess with all of us.
They're great people, and they got my back, let me just say that. So it was even the women, so, you know, pretty awesome. But yeah,
I wouldn't want to take on those English Foundry women. They're like, they're good.
So we're in one piece today, so thanks for that. Yeah, what a great time. And it was always, you know, awesome hanging with you guys as well as part of the NAB. And it's one reason I really like NAB and like going to NAB is spending time with you guys.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to NAB with the hesitation of, like, is this really going to be worth it? And we always come back with, like, it was good to see this. It was really good to see. I mean, there's always just enough stuff.
Jeff, at 1 o'clock, editing the night before you were going live, I would have answered that question slightly differently.
Yeah, I know. I woke up with my head down, sitting in front of my laptop, processing stills and to get them ready for, you know, cutaway stuff. And
I wanted to get a t-shirt made. Said, tell me again why we do this?
Yeah, Ryan noted the timestamp of one of my movies at 2:30 in the morning. So nothing like the adrenaline. Adrenaline of a live netcast. It really is a blast once you get into it and get in the flow of it. So we really appreciate the comments from those of you who are watching and tweeting during it. So
from
it
around
really
the
helps
world,
make it worthwhile for us.
All right, guys. Check you later.
Bye.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide, LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.